Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Edward Woodford, co-founder of Zero Hash and the current CEO. And prior to Zero Hash, Edward was actually at a series of hedge funds, and in 2018 was named Forbes 30 Under 30. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Bit of a tongue twister with my name, I know.
It got me. I got to tell you, usually I'm pretty spot on, but that one really took me for a loop. But I figured to start, maybe we could have you start by walking everyone through a little bit of your background and sort of who you are.
Yeah, sure. So super brief, you know, obviously grew up in the UK, hence the accent. Came to the US for grad school. So after graduating from MIT, worked on a startup in the emerging agricultural space, and then moved into digital assets. And so 2.5 years ago, Zero Hash was formed, and we are now a completely remote company, but I'm based currently in Chicago.
And then, so maybe you could start also by describing, you know, what it is that Zero Hash does and what you sort of hopefully seek to do in the coming years.
Yeah. So really simply, Zero Hash is defining this new vertical of crypto as a service, enabling any traditional group to offer crypto essentially through a couple of lines of code with us and without any technical overhead. So think of us similar to banking as a service or what brokerage as a service did, which was enabling groups to offer digital assets or to offer, you know, banking services or brokerage services. We're doing the same thing. So basically anyone with a customer base is potentially a customer of ours. We service neobanks such as Moneyline, Wirex, and others. We service broker dealers. We're servicing a bunch of buy now, pay later firms as well. So really just offering people crypto where they already do everything else today.
And so what's the benefit of partnering with someone like Zero Hash as opposed to maybe, you know, building this out internally at these companies themselves?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of companies actually don't want to build out back office. I mean, this is fundamentally why SaaS infrastructure exists in crypto, right? The reason why Apex exists or Drive Wealth exists in brokerage space, or why Cross River Bank exists in the banking as a service space. Really, the key drivers are, one, you don't need to take on any regulatory burden. Two, you don't need to have crypto on your balance sheet, which is what a lot of people don't want to currently have, especially if they're doing this at a regulated entity, such as if they're doing this at a FINRA, a broker dealer, for example, and there's no regulatory overhead or no technical lift for them. So they can get to market super, super quickly is really the key selling point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I imagine it's one of the questions we get asked most often here at Yield Street is, you know, when are you going to be doing more in crypto? And I imagine that's a question being asked to most platforms out there that provide some form of financial services. I guess my question is then, you know, who are some of the biggest competitors that you have out there and kind of what differentiates you relative to them?
Yeah, I mean, look, the opportunity here, I think, is massive, right? So any group that offers brokerage services, you know, there's already great case studies out there, such as Robinhood, right? Robinhood offered crypto side by side and built out a massive crypto business. That is clearly a great driver for every other brokerage firm globally to offer digital assets. If you look at, for example, Square Cash, same thing. It's an incredible driver. So if you look at every single kind of fintech vertical, there's a great case study out there, and you know, you're going to get a lot of fast followers, I think, in this space. So fundamentally, my view around the crypto space is that effectively almost any company in the world is potentially a customer of ours. So there's going to be lots of multi-billion dollar infrastructure businesses out there like us. I would say that the closest competitor to us is probably a group like Paxos. I really like the Paxos team. I actually think they're great people. The main differences between us are fundamentally, one is we offer many more digital assets. I think they offer less than 6. We offer now over 40. And just from a technological perspective, we have a much broader product offering. So for example, we offer not only the ability to buy and sell digital assets, we offer the ability to issue crypto rewards, such as when you swipe your credit card or debit card. We've built out an NFT infrastructure. We're building out a staking and DeFi infrastructure within the next quarter as well. And so crypto is much, much broader than just Bitcoin and Ethereum. And it's much, much broader now than just buy and sell. And I think that's really the differentiator around Zero Hash.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned all the different products that you guys allow some of these companies to partner with and for you to offer. I guess my question is then, you know, maybe you could go a little bit deeper on some of those products that you offer and then also help us imagine, you know, I think many people are becoming very well versed in just kind of the trading components of some of these digital coins, but there's obviously technology underpinning. And then also, you know, there's new iterations of what you can do with these coins, including rewards, as you mentioned. So maybe you could just walk us through a little bit more in depth, some of the different products that you offer, and then also maybe more broadly products that you don't yet offer, but maybe hopefully are coming soon that haven't yet maybe even been imagined.
Yeah. So really most simply is buy and sell, right? The ability to offer effectively a marketplace within your own application. And we provide, you know, the entire suite of offering, including liquidity around that in about 40 different assets. Another great and I think really fast growing space is the reward space. So, for example, we recently announced one of the largest credit card as a service providers, Deserve, actually partnered with us to be able to offer crypto rewards now natively when you use one of the cards that they effectively support. Crypto rewards is interesting. One, because I think it's actually a super interesting way to redeem rewards or just instantaneously give people crypto as a reward. But just from an entry perspective, a lot of people say, okay, and you mentioned this, right? Yield Street gets a lot of questions about when are you going to do more in crypto? A lot of people are very interested in rewards because it offers a very easy way to enter the crypto space. You're not offering a marketplace or an invest product, which sometimes has more complexity, both from a technical perspective and just from a philosophical perspective. Do you want to be offering the ability to effectively take positions on crypto? Rewards is a really riskless way for firms to enter the crypto space. So rewards for us is a massively growing part of our ecosystem in particular. Another, you know, sub-vertical of our products is NFTs. So effectively, NFTs can be pretty much anything. NFTs, you know, just a quick 101 on NFTs. NFTs can basically be built on 3 fundamental blockchains currently. There will certainly be more, and I'm simplifying grossly, but effectively it's Ethereum, Solana, and then Polygon Matic. And we support those blockchains, and therefore we can support NFTs on those blockchains. And, you know, a ton of innovators are launching super interesting products on NFTs, and we support that. And I think you're going to start to see a lot more brokerage firms, for example, offer what they call collectibles. So NFTs are now being termed collectibles by different groups. And so that's our NFT product, which we think is super, super interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, NFTs, I think we're also finding have a lot of practical use as well, right? And there's certainly the component around digital art and obviously, you know, collectibles in those sense, but also then, you know, just a way to help people track the legacy and history of certain different collectibles, including things like paintings of art, right? That now we'll likely start to see an infusion of NFTs in sense of the technology that underpins them and really allowed for the ledger to kind of track where this piece of art has been to hopefully help reduce some of the fraud that's in the market.
And I think one of the reasons I'm so bullish on NFTs is because I'm bullish about the creator economy, right? I mean, you've got your own podcast, for example. We live in this creator economy. If you look at Substack for journalists, if you look at, you know, things like OnlyFans as well, We live in this massively creator economy, and NFTs is really just an add-on to that creator economy and really is a great way to democratize that access and allow creators to create value creations as they already create content or anything else.
And then, one other thing you mentioned, you mentioned Ethereum and some other blockchain/cryptos. And, you know, I certainly see each day, it feels like there's 10,000 new ones coming out each week. How does someone kind of make sense of, you know, which ones to follow, which ones to actually take note of versus what feels like kind of like the boom bust and kind of, you know, a little bit of the retail kind of like the retail trade that feels a little bit more like a bubble, knowing that there's obviously new currencies or coins coming out on almost a daily basis. And you see some of the returns associated with them. They're up 62X in 1 to 2 days or so.
Yeah. I mean, look, there is that certain part of the ecosystem, right? And indeed, you know, things like Shiba Inu and Dogecoin are now, you know, in the top 15 largest cryptocurrencies. So that is certainly part of this ecosystem. I can't necessarily talk about these currencies, you know, doing 62X because we don't play in that space, and I don't play in that space personally. I like to take a more thematic approach to invest in digital assets. So I basically say, what am I bullish on? And what do those fundamental, and what are the buckets of assets that can give me exposure to that thesis? So for example, you know, just to continue the trend, NFTs. I'm pretty bullish on NFTs because I'm bullish on the creator economy. How are NFTs going to be launched and what are they going to be built on? It's those three fundamental blockchains. So I have allocation to those three fundamental blockchains. I'm then bullish as well that Dogecoin and Shiba Inu and these other coins will continue to exist. And that actually burns Ethereum. And so that makes me bullish on Ethereum. And so I try to take more of a thematic approach as opposed to kind of pick in individual coins, basically.
We're getting a little technical here, which I appreciate. I just want to make sure we have some maybe additional education around it. But, you know, I guess my first question is, why are NFTs only essentially built on those three technologies as opposed to being available essentially across any of the different technologies?
Yeah, it's just effectively how they were built, right? They exist.
Is there anything stopping them, I guess, from being built on a Bitcoin or anything else?
It's typically around the smart contract infrastructure. So these aspects have the ability to have smart contracts, and that allows you to build basically NFTs. That is really the fundamental point. Now, there are lots and lots of other blockchains that can do this. The fundamental reason is distribution, right? So I can build on an awesome blockchain, but if there's no distribution, then I can't send it to anyone, right? Because you need the wallet to be able to receive the NFT once it's effectively created. And so it's a function of what is the technology and what is the distribution of that technology. And that's how people are deciding between these, effectively these two or three blockchains that are currently predominant in the NFT space. That will certainly change, I think, over the next 3 years.
Yeah. And then the other thing you mentioned was that some of these meme coins are also kind of burning Ethereum, right? And maybe you can kind of explain how those two coins can be related, even if you think about maybe just exposure to one of them.
Yeah. So basically ETH burning is a construct that during high periods of transaction volume, Ethereum can be burned. And so it's a pretty technical process, but effectively Shiba Inu and Dogecoin are built on Ethereum, right? They're ERC-20 coins. And so the more transaction volume that there is, and I'm talking about on-chain transaction volume, I'm not talking about an off-chain transaction, but those two things are pretty linked. The more on-chain volume that there is, the more Ethereum burning that there will be. And so I you know, people are moving Shiba Inu all over the place. People are moving Dogecoin all over the place. That drives up effectively the usage of the Ethereum blockchain. And then that then has a corollary on the burning. But you know, even without that kind of technical point, if you just take the very simple view, hey, Ethereum is being used more, and therefore the utility of this blockchain is increasing, and therefore the price will increase. You know, that you can take that kind of thematic view from an investment perspective.
Yeah, and I know we've gotten a little bit off, you know, zero hash, but this is always interesting to us. And I guess, you know, one thing that we've heard is that obviously when you can't really assign a fundamental value to something, it's a little bit more challenging to figure out, you know, if you're overpaying or perhaps even underpaying in certain respects. You know, when you think about, you know, just digital coins altogether, and you mentioned obviously taking a more thematic approach, how do you base that versus, you know, kind of any one entry point in terms of whether or not you think, you know, something's currently maybe a little bit overbought or potentially even a little bit oversold?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not traded by any means. And I actually take very long-term views on all of this. I mean, will there be some form of correction? I mean, for sure, right? We just hit record volumes or record prices in Bitcoin. We hit record price in Ethereum as well. Typically, when you do that, there's a big sell-off and you fall back down. So I'm more long-term in the space as opposed to kind of a daily trader. I don't enjoy, it's too volatile that it's just not enjoyable to daily trade, at least for me personally.
Yeah, you got to have a pretty thickly lined stomach in order to handle some of it. You know, it's always great when it's great, right?
Exactly.
But getting back to zero hash, you know, what are some, you know, obviously we can all kind of imagine ways that, you know, zero hash can certainly especially in the B2B side, sort of, you know, act as the way for a lot of these companies to get or offer their customers exposure to digital assets. But I guess kind of, you know, what are some of the big initiatives that Zero Hash is thinking about in the coming 18, 24 months or so?
Yeah. So just fundamentally, Zero Hash is a B2B2C business, right? So everybody accesses crypto infrastructure through us, but it's through a partner. So for example, Moneyline, you're a customer of Moneyline, you are fully disclosed to Zero Hash for legal purposes, but all of the interaction will occur at the Moneyline app, at the app that you're used to. The same thing with Tastyworks or any other of our clients. One of the big things that we're building out is a staking infrastructure that we'll be launching within the next 2 months, which we're very excited about. And just very quickly, what staking is staking is effectively generating a return for staking your assets. So there's obviously two types of things. There's proof of work, which is effectively Bitcoin, and there's proof of stake. And proof of stake, you stake your assets, and for staking those assets and for effectively providing the validation for the entire blockchain, you earn an inverted commas yield on that. And so if you're a long-term hodler of proof of stake assets, you likely want to stake those assets because you can effectively generate more of that asset that you're already bullish on. And so things like Solana and other, you know, Cardano are things that we're launching staking on. The other big thing that we're launching is access to DeFi protocols. So DeFi protocols are interesting because they effectively give you the ability to generate a rate of return for putting a USD equivalent, i.e. USDC, and putting it onto a DeFi protocol. You know, one of the most, there's really two prominent protocols in this space. It's really Compound and Aave. And you can generate between 4 to 6% for doing so. And people always ask me, well, how can you generate 4 to 6%? How does that work? Well, I try to break it down into like three main buckets. One is, it's pretty complex to do, right? So there's a premium for that. There's also, I would say, a true risk-free rate. The Fed is keeping interest rates artificially low. If there was a real risk-free rate, what would that be? So that's the second component. So those two components. And then there's a third component, which is undoubtedly risk, right? There is risk involved with this. In anything that is code, there are bugs. There was a code bug in Compound a few weeks ago that actually gave away, in inverted commas, free Compound. So there's risk-free rate. And people take different views on those three combinations, whether or not they actually know that they're doing this in their head. I break it down into those three buckets. So I actually think, personally, the risk-free rate is about 3%-ish. Then there's like a, hey, this is complex rate. You know, there's a couple of basis points there that is complex and expensive to do. And then there's a risk rate. And I'm not sure exactly what the risk rate is. And people take different views on that. And that effectively, those three pieces is what generates the yield from Compound and Aave. That's kind of how I break it down.
Yeah, it's funny. It's actually literally most of the foundational concepts, and I'm sure you're aware of this, of most fixed income and equity markets in the world. Everything's obviously based on the amount of risk you're taking incremental to the risk-free rate, which, you know, certainly is low right now and compressing yields across the board, which, you know, many of our listeners, investors certainly know about some of the some of the pressures that exist out there in the market. I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, quite a bit about staking, and I'm curious maybe if you could also contrast that versus, you know, crypto-backed loans or equivalent, which a lot of people I think are just starting to learn about as well.
Yeah, so staking is fundamentally different to loans. Staking, you actually maintain control of your assets, right? So staking is a technical thing that you're doing. You do have to, you stake and then you can unstake, and those things aren't necessarily instantaneous. They depend on the actual blockchain, but it's fundamentally different. Crypto loans typically are centralized. So for example, Coinbase just announced the ability to loan out your crypto or your Bitcoin up to $1 million of cash. Effectively, what you're doing is you're doing a collateralized loan, right? With Bitcoin or with any asset. And typically, you're taking a massive haircut because there's significant volatility in the asset that you're using to collateralize the loan. And so really, just Bitcoin loans are just collateralized loans. That's all they really are.
No, that's really helpful. And then, so, you know, as you think about, you know, how blockchain crypto will kind of continue to evolve and kind of, you know, again, become larger and larger or more adopted in people's personal lives, how do you kind of imagine going forward outside of it just being an investment? How do you sort of imagine how crypto and blockchain sort of really become a part of everyone's everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that within the next 12 months, every single person in North America will be able to purchase crypto from an account where they already have opened. So they won't need to open up a new account. And I think that has a massive, massive impact in terms of adoption. You know, more globally, you know, the adoption of crypto in certain parts is actually much, much higher than here in the United States and in Canada. And that's just because of a function of how people view crypto more as a, you know, means of transfer as opposed to a store of value. I mean, I think there's so many theses here that you can buy into, right? If you buy into the gaming thesis around NFTs, for example, if you buy into the value of stable coins as a transfer mechanism and how that reduces costs and streamlines and it's 24/7 out, 24/7, you know, element, you know, if you believe in the creator economy, how NFTs will play into that. So fundamentally, crypto is a technology. It can touch every part of everybody's lives. It's not to say that it will be the case, but I think it will touch very large pieces of people's lives and it will fundamentally disrupt and change the way that we do certain things every single day. And so I do think in the next 2 years, a majority of people around the world will interact with digital assets on a daily basis.
And you mentioned that the likelihood of not having to open up a new account, you just mean that a lot of the large brokerage firms or equivalent will likely start introducing either through Zerohash or perhaps building out themselves or however they decide to allow for some trading or at least custody type of these coins. You imagine the Fidelities, the E-Trades, all of them will soon enable within your current account to own such assets?
Yep, within your account, whether it be a neobank that you already are onboarded to, whether it be a bank, a brokerage, a buy now, pay later aspect, an investment registered investment advisor, every single one of those, you know, areas of finance, verticals of finance are already in crypto. And I think that's going to lead other adopters very, very quickly. So,
And then I'm kind of going back now and remembering, you know, when we were discussing earlier, you talked about the kind of this introduction of crypto rewards, right? In many cases, people obviously typically sort of primed to the idea of earning rewards for, you know, purchases on a credit carding. Maybe those points are worth something on an airline or equivalent. Are there any implied taxes for earning sort of crypto or at least some fractional component of crypto via the rewards program? Or is this kind of a, you know, again, more traditional reward where there's maybe less tax implications?
Yeah, I mean, I think the honest answer with anything with tax with crypto is that it's evolving, right? And it will change. And honestly, there's a lot of clarification that's needed. Right now, people are treating it more as a reward, right? Where it's not necessarily a taxable piece, but obviously the gain on that reward, right? So the initial issuance, if I give you $10 worth of Bitcoin, a lot of people are treating that as not taxable. But if that Bitcoin then goes from $10 to $10 million, right? Which is what happened 10 years ago, $10 worth of Bitcoin today would be worth over $10 million. That delta is what is taxable. And actually one of the drivers is a customer demand for crypto rewards, but there's actually an issuance demand as well. The way that rewards have to be accounted for on most companies' books is actually quite expensive. So, you know, just to use airline miles, when basically people stopped traveling during COVID, sales went off the cliff. And then people had all of these points that people weren't using. And those points have to be recognized on your balance sheet effectively as a liability. Mm-hmm. And so if you can get people to spend those points more quickly, such as through crypto, there's actually that demand from the actual points issuer to actually offer crypto rewards. So it's actually a two-sided demand that we're starting to see within the reward space.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We're getting close to running up on time here. So I want to ask you one final question, then also turn over to you to see if there's anything else that we didn't get a chance to talk about today. So I guess my question is, are you Satoshi?
No.
Okay, we have to ask everyone that. We can never be too careful. Next up was just around anything that we didn't get a chance to cover that you thought we should have.
No, I think we covered everything. I mean, if you're just interested to connect with me, more than happy to do so. My email is just edward@zerohash.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn as well. It's just Edward Woodford.
Yeah, I think Zerohash is actually one of those really interesting companies out there because so many times, to your point, you see who you interact with, mm-hmm. And not necessarily the technology that kind of powers some of those different experiences that are available. So really cool to hear and learn a little bit more about the companies that are actually powering future companies or other companies that we interact with and their kind of expansion into the crypto space.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is great. And for everyone else to listen to other episodes of The Yield, please visit and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. And for any questions on YieldTreat, please visit www.yieldtreat.com or email us at investments@yieldtreat.com.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.